Often vulgar, always explicit, and sometimes funny.
Slap box. Slap box.
Welcome to the Slapbox Podcast. This is episode 664. I am your host, Josh Albrecht, recording once again inside the Slapbox penthouse. My trusty sidekick, Agent Fox Mulder, the three-legged kitty cat, is laying next to the soundboard so he could start fucking with things at any moment now. Actually, as soon as I said that, he disappeared. Oh, he's down by my feet now. He's got 14 minutes before his automatic feeder goes off again, so he's going to be very animated, shall we say. Yes. This is we're two away from 666. I don't know what happens at that point. Maybe the world ends. The world ends on episode 666. Who knows at this point? I mean, enough craziness is going on. Two nuclear powers are at war with each other right now, Pakistan and India. And that wouldn't have been my money. I wouldn't have had my money on those being the two nuclear powers to go to war. You know, though I don't really know that much about the, I mean, I know a little bit about the history of India and Pakistan, but you know, that there's not a lot of love there, but I mean, I would have thought we would have directly attacked Russia, which I guess we have attacked Russia in the past, just not directly, you know, with the through the Cold War and just arming, you know, even up to now with arming Ukraine and whatnot. You know, you look at the Korean conflict. I guess that was the first instances of us attacking each other, from what I understand. And, you know, the Vietnam War, indirectly attacking each other. Anyway, yeah. So far, I don't think there's any nuclear bombs that have, missiles or whatnot, have been launched. So that's a plus. But, hey, on the positive, I guess the positive, Alcatraz could be reopened. Of all the things you could decide to do as a president, you know, like the things that need to be done, reopen Alcatraz, because, you know, being the nation in the world with the largest prisoner population by far, I do believe, being the U.S., it was like, you know what, we need another prison. One with more prestige. One with a lot of history to it. And that is so run down that it would cost, what, a billion? I don't know. It would cost an insane amount of money to refurbish Alcatraz. It's a bit ridiculous. Apparently, it was Trump had gotten the idea via watching the Clint Eastwood classic, which I love the film, Escape from Alcatraz. Following the true story of, was it three inmates that tried to escape, and there was never any proof that they lived or died, really. You know, there's, with anything historical like that, the D.B. Cooper, you know, incident is sort of up there with that kind of hype to it, and that no one ever really concretely proved who D.B. Cooper was. And nor that he survived the jump after the big heist he had on the airplane. You know, I feel like that's kind of like the same story with the escape from Alcatraz, which was always sold, you know, back in the day, that no one could survive that swim. People do that swim, like, I believe on a fairly regular occurrence now. Now, granted, these are people that do a lot of swimming and, like, get trained for it, you know. The prisoners would have had a little bit of a challenge training for that swim. it's classic Clint Eastwood, though, the escape from Alcatraz. And it would appear that, after watching that, in Florida at Mar-a-Lago there, that, El Presidente thought, you know what? We need to reopen Alcatraz. That's going to be what makes America great again. I did like this. That whole story is pretty great. I do love that story. And I think the problem is, though, if you're going to reopen Alcatraz, then you're going to have to really set us back in a lot of other ways. I mean, we're going to need like gangsters from, because that was where like the big time gangsters went. Like Al Capone spent time there. We need high profile criminals, or maybe just like supervillains of that, of like a Batman nature. We need to up our game on criminals. We don't have Machine Gun Kellys or, you know, Bonnie and Clyde. Of course, I don't think they were ever in Alcatraz, but Machine Gun Kelly was. Not the artist from today. He may have toured it now that it's a tourist attraction, but I refer to the OG Machine Gun Kelly. You know, the guy that killed people and was a gangster. which, if you watch the classic Mike Myers film, So I Married an Axe Murderer, Phil Hartman's great part in there, he played, of course, a former guard at Alcatraz that's now our tour guide, and he tells Mike Myers a story about Machine Gun Kelly cutting his bitch's eyes out with a shiv and then fucking him, skull fucking him, something along those lines. It's been a minute since I've watched So I Married an Axe Murderer. But classic film. And Phil Hartman, only in it briefly, but that part is very memorable. And, of course, they are in Alcatraz for that, as he's taking a tour of Alcatraz. But, yeah, the story of those guys escaping, though. I mean, they were awfully inventive, or crafty, shall we say. They knew their crafts. They made, life preservers and a raft and shit out of, like, raincoats. And now whether or not that shit survived going over the bay there, who's to say? I believe they found parts of it. but that being said, they also fashioned, of course, mannequins and used, like, hair from the barbershop to make hair for the mannequins that they put in their bunks at night to show that they were still asleep in their beds. And that was quite the... I mean, it was quite... I mean, sure, there were criminals. I don't remember what what it was. I'm gonna look up the actual facts. There we go. I want to know the deets on... Here we go. This is the FBI's. Well, of course, may have updated this now. Now that they're rewriting history of the FBI and whatnot. if there was any diversity, equity, or inclusion in this article, then it's been wiped away. Which these were all white guys that escaped. So I'm thinking maybe they didn't fuck with it. But according to FBI.gov here. Alcatraz escape. It says, in its heyday, it was the ultimate maximum security prison, which it should be noted. America has some extremely crazy, like maximum security prisons here in the States that no one can escape from, that are landlocked. They're inside the continental United States. They're not off on a fucking island. And much easier to maintain and whatnot. And we don't really need an Alcatraz, but that's neither here nor there. anyway, back to Alcatraz and the escape here. In its heyday, it was the ultimate maximum security prison, located on a lonely island in the middle of San Francisco Bay, Alcatraz, a.k.a. The Rock. Which, side note, right before I started recording this, of course I had to look up I haven't seen The Rock, the movie The Rock, with Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage, in many years. But I had to look up the moment wherein Nicolas Cage goes, "I'll do my best," and then Conrad A4 replies, "Your best. Losers always complain about the best," or something about the best. "Well, winners go home and fuck the prom queen." Something along those lines. Oh, but oh, I just love the part where he's like, "Your best." Yeah, anyway, back to the escape. The Rock had held captive since the Civil War, but it was in 1934, the high point of a major war on crime, that Alcatraz was refortified into the world's most secure prison. It's 1934. Just saying, that's almost 100 years. Well, I mean, it's like 91 years ago. It's in a little bit of disrepair since then. We had different standards back then, too. That was the maximum, most secure prison in 1934. Anyway, its eventual inmates included dangerous public enemies like Al Capone and George Machine Gun Kelly. Which I forgot his first name was George. Anyway, criminals who had a history of escapes and the occasional odd character like the infamous Birdman of Alcatraz. In the 1930s, Alcatraz was already a forbidding place surrounded by the cold, rough waters of the Pacific. The redesign included tougher iron bars, a series of strategically positioned guard towers, and strict rules, including a dozen checks a day of the prisoners. Escape seemed near impossible. Despite the odds, however, from 1934 until the prison was closed in 1963, 36 men tried 14 separate escapes. Nearly all were caught or didn't survive the attempt. The fate of three particular inmates, however, remains a mystery to this day. Here is their story. The escapees. Frank Morris arrived at Alcatraz in January of 1960 after convictions for bank robbery, burglary, and other crimes and repeated attempts to escape various prisons. Later that year, a convict by the name of John Englund was sent to Alcatraz, followed by his brother Clarence in early 1961. All three knew each other from previous stints in prison. Assigned to adjoining cells, they began hatching a plan to escape. Morris, known for his intelligence, took the lead in the planning. They were aided by another inmate, Alan West. Missing on June 12, 1962, the routine early morning bed check turned out to be anything but. Three convicts, not in their cells, John Englund, his brother Clarence, and Frank Morris. In their beds were cleverly built dummies made of plaster, flesh-tone paint, and real human hair that apparently fooled the night guards. The prison went into lockdown and an intensive search began. Which I could see, I mean, the heads don't look realistic. I mean, they do-ish, but the look of them definitely, like, in the dark, I can imagine. Just like, oh, that, I mean, you see the real human hair, you're like, you're good to go. Anyway, gathering the clues. We were notified immediately and asked to help. Our office, we as in the FBI, our office in San Francisco set leads for offices nationwide to check for any records on the missing persons and or their previous escape attempts. All three had made them. We also interviewed relatives of the men and compiled all their identification records and asked boat operators in the bay to be on the lookout for debris. Within 2 days, a packet of letters sealed in rubber and related to the men was recovered. Later, some paddle-like pieces of wood and bits of rubber inner tubes were found in the water. A homemade life vest was also discovered washed up on Cronkite Beach, but extensive searches did not turn up any other items in the area. Piecing together the plan here is Agent Fox Mulder just went down to get his meal. Says, as the days went by, the FBI, the Coast Guard, Bureau of Prison Authorities, and others began to find more evidence and piece together the ingenious escape plan. We were aided by inmate Alan West, who didn't make it out of his cell in time and began providing us with information. Here's what we learned. The group had begun laying out plans the previous December when one of them came across some old saw blades. Using crude tools, including a homemade drill made from the motor of a broken vacuum cleaner, the plotters each loosened the air vents at the back of their cells by painstakingly drilling closely spaced holes around the cover so the entire section of the wall could be removed. Once through, they hid the holes with whatever they could, a suitcase, a piece of cardboard, etc. Behind the cells was a common, unguarded utility corridor. They made their way down this corridor and climbed to the roof of their cell block inside the building, where they set up a secret workshop. There, taking turns keeping watch for the guards in the evening before the last count. They had a periscope. They used a crude periscope to do that. They used a variety of stolen and donated materials to build and hide what they needed to escape. More than 50 raincoats that they stole or gathered were turned into makeshift life preservers and a 6x14-foot rubber raft. The seams carefully stitched together and vulcanized by the hot steam pipes in the prison. The idea came from magazines that were found in the prisoners' cells. They also built wooden paddles and converted a musical instrument into a tool to inflate the raft. That's a lot of work to go through. Vulcanize the ship, man. Vulcanized in the rubber. At the time, they were looking for a way out of the building. The ceiling was a good 30 feet high. But using a network of pipes, they climbed up and eventually pried open the ventilator at the top of the shaft. They kept it in place temporarily by fashioning a fake bolt out of soap. God damn, man. This is quite inventive here. The escape here. On the evening of June 11th, they were ready to go. West, though, did not have his ventilator grill completely removed and was left behind. Just, I guess, sucks for him. Although maybe they would have survived. Maybe he was I mean, I don't know. Maybe they died, maybe they didn't. It says, the three others got into the corridor, gathered their gear, climbed up and out through the ventilator, and got on the prison roof. Then they shimmied down the bakery smokestack at the rear of the cell house, climbed over the fence, and snuck to the northeast shore of the island and launched their raft. I would venture to guess, though, if one of these fuckers did make it out, at least on their deathbed or something, they'd be like, they'd have to fucking tell somebody, right? Be like, I fucking escaped from Alcatraz. This is my real name. I'm John Anglin or whoever the fuck. Anyway, the mystery continues. What happens next remains a mystery. Did they make it across the bay, get to Angel Island, and then cross Raccoon Strait into Marin County as planned? Or did the wind and waves get the better of them? Plenty of people have gone to great lengths to prove that the men could have survived, but the question remains, did they? Our investigation at the time concluded otherwise for the following reasons. Crossing the bay, yes, youngsters have made the more than mile-long swim from Alcatraz to Angel Island, but with the strong currents and frigid bay water, the odds were clearly against these men. Three, if by land, the plan, according to our prison informant, was to steal clothes and a car once on land, but we never uncovered any thefts like this despite the high-profile nature of the case. Family ties, if the escapees had help, we couldn't substantiate it. The families appeared unlikely to even have the financial means to provide any real support. And missing in action. For the 17 years we worked on the case, no credible evidence emerged to suggest the men were still alive, either in the U.S. or overseas. The FBI officially closed its case on December 31st, 1979, and turned over responsibility to the U.S. Marshals Service, which continues to investigate it in the unlikely event the trio is still alive. I mean, they'd probably be fucking dead of old age by now anyway. These guys were criminals. On top of that, you know, probably not living their best life. Although, I mean, they had some intelligence. They were able to fucking think things through enough to, like, vulcanize some rubber. Make a fake bolt out of soap. I guess that's not, like, a real smart thing. I mean, it's inventive, I guess. Using the things you have in your hands. It's I'm thinking they probably died, but it's pretty cool to think, you know, maybe they did escape, as we'll never truly know, right? mean, those bodies are long gone at this point. They've been at the bottom of that bay, or like fucking, you know, the current took them out to the ocean. You know, I mean, those bodies are long gone. There's no way you'd ever find those. Long, long gone. Anyway, but yeah, Alcatraz. I mean, this could, if I'm going to be sent somewhere, I got, you know, if I'm going to be taken away just because I have a viewpoint that is against the current administration, if I'm going to go somewhere, at least I could be like, I survived. I went to Alcatraz. I feel like I got to be like, start a real life of crime, though, if I'm going to do that. I'm not worthy of Alcatraz. I don't think I'll ever be. I don't want to. I don't want to go to prison at all, really. But anyway, I do have some fun facts here. 10 things you may not know about Alcatraz, which I don't know a whole lot about it, other than it's called The Rock. Anyway, this is on history.com, and it says, number one here, Al Capone played banjo in the inmate band. Now, I got to say, if I were to pick an instrument Al Capone would be playing, it wouldn't be the banjo. Doesn't strike me as a banjo guy. I mean, I could see him playing maybe the harmonica, especially, you know, it's just an prison thing. As Mulder here got done eating, and he's just wanting to say hi. Foxinator. Calm down, buddy. Get off the soundboard. Get off the soundboard. Ah, come here. It's okay, buddy. It's okay. All right. He wants to say hi. You want to learn about Alcatraz, buddy? You going to go there with me? Anyway, he's trying to bite me. Capone here did play banjo in the inmate band as I'm like avoiding trying to get bit by a cat. The notorious gangster and mob boss was among the first prisoners to occupy the new Alcatraz federal prison in August of 1934. Capone had bribed guards to receive preferential treatment. Oh, I don't know why I was having such a hard time saying that. While serving his tax evasion sentence in Atlanta, but that changed after his transfer to the island prison. The conditions broke Capone. It looks like Alcatraz has got me licked, he reportedly told his warden. In fact, convict number 85 became so cooperative that he was permitted to play banjo in the Alcatraz prison band, the Rock Islanders. Well, that's kind of a cool name. We're the Rock Islanders, and I'm going to rock the banjo. They regularly gave Sunday concerts for other inmates. That'd be interesting to have. Be like a prisoner in here, like, holy shit, is that Al Capone on banjo? No shit, is that Scarface? Number two here was, there were no confirmed prisoner escapees from Alcatraz. A total of 36 inmates, but the supposedly escape proof, yeah, we got into that. I don't think I need to cover that again. Number three, Alcatraz is named for seabirds. Before criminals became its denizens, the windswept island was home to large colonies of brown pelicans. When Spanish Lieutenant Juan Manuel de Ayala became the first known European to sail through the Golden Gate in 1775, he christened the rocky outcrop La Isla de las Alcatraces, meaning an island of pelicans, and I'm sure I grossly mispronounced that, just like horribly. La Isla de los Alcatraces. Anyway, the name eventually became anglicized to Alcatraz. With the inmates gone, gulls and cormorants are now the most plentiful inhabitants of Alcatraz. I don't know what cormorants are. Number four, in spite of his nickname, the Birdman of Alcatraz had no birds in the prison. I think it was Sing Sing. Let's get into here. While Robert Stroud was serving a manslaughter sentence for killing a bartender in a brawl, he fatally stabbed a guard at Leavenworth Prison in 1916. After President Woodrow Wilson commuted his death sentence to a life of permanent solitary confinement, Stroud began to study ornithological diseases, the study of birds. My tongue is all fucked up today, apparently. Yeah. he studied bird diseases, write straight two books, and raise canaries and other birds in his Leavenworth cell. He was ordered to give up his birds in 1931, and he was banned from having any avian cellmates during his 17 years inside Alcatraz, which began in 1942. 1962 movie Birdman of Alcatraz, for which Burt Lancaster received an Academy Award nomination just weeks before The Rock closed, was largely fictitious. It was extremely fictitious. If you want a good, you know, person to like find some shit out about, Robert Stroud was a fucked up individual. And I don't remember what documentary or whatever I was watching, but it got into Robert Stroud a little bit. And that guy was really fucked up. And the whole only reason why he got into taking care of the birds is there was like a baby bird had broken its wings or something like that, and he started taking care of it. Well, he got the shit to do all like the at Leavenworth, they let him to do all the shit to take care of the birds. Well, he used that stuff to make alcohol. It wasn't that he really gave a shit about birds. The stuff he was using for the ornithology was just a front so he can make all this fucking prison hooch. And I don't know. I don't remember if he drank it so much or those he used it to barter with people. Maybe both. But he was a sick individual. After the Birdman of Alcatraz movie had come out, there was children like writing the fucking warden asking for his like release, because he's such a sweet guy. He's such a sweet guy. He was not at the time they were writing those letters. He was writing child pornography, like fanfic, in his fucking cell. Like Robert Stroud was a really fucked up individual. But they made a movie about him, Birdman of Alcatraz, and how he was so sweet. So sweet. Anyway, number five here. After the prison stood dormant for 6 years, Native American activists occupied Alcatraz. Following two previous brief occupations, a group of nearly 100 Native American activists, led by Mohawk Richard Oakes, took over the island in November of 1969, citing an 1868 treaty that granted unoccupied federal land to Native Americans. The protesters demanded the deed to Alcatraz in order to establish a university and cultural center. Their proclamation included an offer to purchase the island for $24 in glass beads and red cloth, the same price reportedly paid by Dutch settlers for Manhattan in 1626. That's fucked up. But hey, you know. Federal marshals removed the last of the protesters in June of 71, but some of their graffiti remains when the National Park Service recently rebuilt an Alcatraz water tower. It made sure to repaint the red graffiti that read, "Peace and freedom, welcome, home of the free Indian land." And what I'm saying, that was fucked up. The whole fact that the Dutch paid that for Manhattan, that's fucked up. Well, $24 was a lot more back then. Imagine it wasn't like $30 million today or anything. But you know, Manhattan, pretty prime real estate these days. Number six here. Military prisoners were Alcatraz's first inmates. Once the gold rush of the 1840s turned San Francisco into a boomtown, Alcatraz was dedicated to military use. The U.S. Army began incarcerating military prisoners inside the new fortress in the late 1850s. During the Civil War, prisoners included Union deserters and Confederate sympathizers. The cells were also used to imprison Native Americans who had land disagreements with the federal government. American soldiers who were deserted to the Filipino cause during the Spanish-American War, and Chinese civilians who resisted the army during the Boxer Rebellion. Number seven here. Alcatraz was home to the Pacific Coast's first lighthouse. Fun fact, when a small lighthouse on top of the Rocky Island was activated in 1854, it became the first of its kind on the west coast of the U.S. The beacon became obsolete in the early 1900s after the U.S. Army constructed a cell house that blocked its view of the Golden Gate. A new, taller lighthouse replaced it in 1909. Number eight here, the country's worst criminals were not automatically shipped to Alcatraz. The convicts housed in Alcatraz were not necessarily those who had committed the most violent or heinous crimes, but they were the convicts most in need of an attitude adjustment. The most incorrigible and disobedient inmates in the federal penal system, they had bribed guards and attempted escapes, and a trip to Alcatraz when it's intended to get them to follow the rules so that they could return to other federal facilities. And number nine, it was possible to swim to shore. Federal officials may have initially doubted that any escaping inmates could survive the swim to the mainland across the cold, swift waters of San Francisco Bay, but it did happen. In 1962, prisoner John Paul Scott bent the bars of a kitchen window and swam to shore. He was so exhausted upon reaching the foot of the Golden Gate Bridge that police discovered him lying unconscious in hypothermic shock. Today, hundreds complete the 1.5-mile swim annually during the Escape from Alcatraz triathlon. And number 10 here, inmates requested transfers to Alcatraz. While Alcatraz was certainly not Club Med, its tough-as-nails reputation was a bit of a Hollywood creation. The prison's one-man-per-cell policy appealed to some inmates, because it made them less vulnerable to attack by fellow jailbirds. Not the kind of birds that old Robert Stroud was dealing with. Alcatraz's first warden, James A. Johnston, knew poor food was often the cause of prison riots, so he prided himself on serving good food, and inmates could return for as many helpings as they wanted. I see the upside of this. Inmates who behaved had access to privileges including monthly movies in a library with 15,000 books and 75 popular magazine subscriptions. Overall, some prisoners considered the conditions inside Alcatraz to be more attractive than at other federal prisons, and several asked to be moved there. I mean, already, knowing about the movies and the books, the cell to myself, dude, I'm going to say that would be my prison of choice. If I have to go to jail, I'd love to have that prison cell to myself. I don't want to have to shit. Man, it's just terrible, too, to have like a toilet in your where you sleep. And, you know, I hate just shitting in my bathroom and then it just stinking up the hallway. I can't imagine if that's also where I sleep and whatnot. It's going to be just terrible. Like, really bad. But also, you know, when you have two people in there and they're bullshitting, and your cell's always going to smell like shit, man. I doubt they have very good ventilation. You cut down on that and you just have one person per cell. Though not, you know, probably a really shitty bed, but, you know, I sleep on a really cheap couch. And so I'm used to, I mean, still probably better than a cell at fucking a bed in Alcatraz. I'll just, for now, have to imagine that to be the case. Because I'm pretty sure I'm not going there. I would be really surprised if we actually opened up Alcatraz. It would be so insanely expensive to fix that place back up and then to maintain it. It would just be, I mean, it would be such a massive waste of money. But, I mean, this is what this current regime is all about. So, only time will tell. I imagine it would take several years to get it to us. Many years to get it to be like a functioning prison. So, but we'll. On the plus side, it'll give a new map for Call of Duty. Because Rebirth Island will be a lot different. They'll have refurbished Alcatraz Island. Well, I guess that's about it on Alcatraz for the day. Maybe we'll learn more about it on episode 666. I know that doesn't necessarily seem a 666 thing. Maybe I'm going to sacrifice a goat or something. Paint out a pentagram in blood where my seat is here, you know. I don't really want to fuck up the carpet, though. Maybe I'll just throw something down. I'll mark it out in toilet paper. I'll just roll some toilet paper out in a pentagram. Anyway, I debated about even mentioning this at all, but the last few episodes, I have been, you know, I've been just loving on the Blues. Loving on the Blues because they had quite the second half to this season. They were looking amazing. They were looking amazing, you know, and I had faith. It had so many just resemblances to the 2019 Cup year, you know, when they won the Cup. I mean, it wasn't exact. Obviously not. They just fucking lost in the playoffs. But, man, it had just that magic vibe. You had Joe Boo in the locker room from Major League, the little statue guy, just giving his magic. And they hadn't lost at home since, like, February sometime. Like, I guess near the end of February was the last time the Blues lost a fucking home game. Still to this day, they're on a home ice win streak. And, oh, man, that last game was, it was tough to watch. It was tough to watch. You know, it was a late game. I had to work the next morning. And, I mean, it went to double overtime. It seemed like it was never going to end. I thought it was going to go to even triple overtime, and it was close to triple overtime. They only had like 4 minutes or something left. And that second overtime before they lost, and it's like, shit, man, they had the lead the entire game. The entire game, they had the lead. Running up through to the last like couple of seconds. It was like I thought originally it was like 1.6 seconds left when Winnipeg scored that last goal to tie it. And send it to overtime. But I don't know, I've heard some people say it was like 3 seconds. Whatever it was like just kill it for a little bit longer, fellas. And you got this. You're moving on. You would have beat the best team in the league as far as the regular season's concerned. I mean, as of recording this, they've already lost one game at home to Dallas. Or as yesterday, they won a game. So they're tied at 1-1. I feel confident Dallas will take Winnipeg. Especially since, you know, the recipe for destroying Hellebuyck, especially in the playoffs, he sucks in the playoffs. He really sucks on the road in the playoffs. Even though he's a Vezina Trophy winner, we'll most likely get the Vezina again this year. his record in the playoffs, not good. Not good. And, you know, I thought the Blues really figured out that formula. At Enterprise Center, they blew him out of the water all three games. And it had seemed on game seven that they were finally like, okay, we're going to do this to them on their home ice. And first period, man, they were fucking them up. And it looked like they were really pushing and they had the gas. They were flooring it that first period. And I really thought they were up like 2-0, I guess, at the end of the first. I don't remember now. It was so long ago now. And I was like, holy shit, they're really sticking to what's been working. I'm wondering if they're going to end up having to pull Hellebuyck on home ice. And, you know, they ended up scoring. It was a 3-1, I guess, at the end of the second period. I really thought, like, holy shit, they might. And then they just, the whole, like, third period, they just played defense. They didn't push at all. They were not trying to put shots on goal. And just kind of trying to just kill time. And I guess that gave Hellebuyck time to regain his composure. And then the Blues just, what killed them, you know, throughout the regular season was when teams pulled their goalie and had that extra attacker. Killed them in the playoffs. They were able to score two goals in a fairly short window and bring it to overtime on the Blues pretty easily. And man, if the Blues would have kept on the attack, I mean, hindsight is 2020. You know, as easy to say that. I mean, had the Blues just been able to score in overtime, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Although it'd still be like, dude, I don't like, had they won, I'd still be like pretty nervous. Like, man, all the team has to do is pull their goalie. And they can just like tie up the game pretty much immediately. All they got to do. Like that's, but it's a shame, you know, that one of the big problems they had is they kept icing it. The Blues kept icing it. Of course, when you ice the puck, you know, the faceoff ends up in your defensive zone by your goalie, and you don't get to do a line change. And so all your players are tired as shit, whereas the other team, that being the Jets, gets a fresh line in there and fresh six guys to your five. And, man, it's tough. It's tough, but, you know, plenty of teams are not. I mean, the Blues were bad. They were near the bottom of the league as far as 6-on-5 is concerned. That's hard to win. But, you know, I mean, it is pretty amazing what they were able to accomplish this year. I mean, they did not look like they were going to make the playoffs. And then they almost beat the President Trophy winning Winnipeg Jets, the number one team in the league. I mean, they were one goal away from moving on. And they were the hottest team in the NHL. They had, I think it was the largest win streak in the NHL. It was either, I do think because it was 12-game win streak, I think they had. I think that was, I think there was another team that had 11. Maybe there was 12. Maybe they tied it. I don't recall. Either way, I mean, they were a hot fucking team. I do think as well, though, had Dylan Holloway not gone out in that Pittsburgh game, then we would have a different story right now. As I feel like if Dylan Holloway was in that lineup, but, you know, that's just the way the playoffs go. It's the next man up. You got to have a full team to be able to go on and win that cup. But had he been in there, I think they would have taken one, possibly two games in Winnipeg. Having him on the ice, I mean, they were scoring a lot more goals when he was in there. When they were on that 12-game win streak, it was fucking insane. It was insanity. They were lighting people up like crazy. Now, granted, they showed that they could score even without Dylan Holloway, but as soon as he got injured, that's when they started losing. That's when that win streak came to an end, although they still managed to win at home. And proved, I mean, they were still a great team without Dylan Holloway. But holy shit, that added an extra level. Him and Kyrou skating together, they were so fast. Both of them so fast on the ice. Just hard to defend. And, you know, hopefully he's apparently had surgery. I don't know exactly the injury. It was some kind of lower body injury. Hopefully he's ready to go. They say he should be ready to go by training camp. Agent Fox, man. Fox Mulder here. Calm down, buddy. You sad about Holloway too? Are you sad about Dylan? Anyway, but I mean, hey, the future looks bright. Thankfully, I didn't record this like the day after that game. Then I'd be like just fucking, just hating the world. Cause it was tough to stomach that as Agent Fox Mulder is hitting my keyboard and doesn't look like he stopped the recording, so we're good there. But it's a shame. You know, now I'm kind of, I was hoping that the Stars would just blow out the Jets. And, they've already screwed that up, but I'll take a win. Unfortunately last night they had a shutout. They, 4-0 after the first game, Dallas really having the hat trick. What's his name eludes me at the moment, but they had, I want to see Hellebuck get pulled from at least one more game. Like, I think it seems that you can get in his head fairly easily, but this is again, hindsight. And also I'm not an NHL player, nor am I that skilled on hockey. I am a casual fan Although I've watched pretty much every Blues game this year, with the exception of like two or three that I just didn't have access to. But yeah, I still hope that that Dallas better at least win the series. Now, I know that there's the argument, you know, if you have your team to make your team look better, you want the team that beat you to win it all. But I don't know. I just feel like I really hate it. I've been so, maybe it's just how invested I was this season in the Blues. You know, I went to five or six games, whatever the fuck it was. I went to one by myself. I went to the Cugio game where he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. And I almost bumped right into Cugio. And I was dumbfounded, couldn't get words out. Then when I looked around for him again, because I had his puck, I was like, oh, maybe I should try to get him signed then. I couldn't find him. Anyway, I'm watching every game. I was like, I'm so invested. And then to see my boys lose when they had it, they fucking had it. It was devastating. And just the shit that hearing Connor Hellebuyck talk, which, you know, to be fair, I mean, the regular season, dude is legit, like, the best goalie in the NHL, stats-wise. Playoffs, you know, he fucking shits the bed. But they hear the fact that after getting pulled in games, like, he leaves. Like, he won't sit on the bench with his team. And I'm a team player kind of guy, man. I feel like you got to support your team. And to just like leave and be like, you know, that's your guys' problem now. I'm out of the game. It's just fucking fuck you, dude. I'd be sitting out there with my helmet still on, like, God damn it, just put me back out there. Even if I was playing like dog shit. You know, I'm just like, fuck that. But and the stuff he had said, I don't remember what the quote was exactly, but something to the fact that he's studied goaltending more than anybody in history is just a very Trumpian thing to say, like, shut the fuck up, dude. Like, I know what to do. Like, fuck you. I was like, you go ahead and choke again, you bastard. Which they, oh man, they were so close to making him completely give it up in the game seven. And they just took the pedal. You know, to be fair, though, I mean, Winnipeg's got a great team. You know, and they're pushing hard on the Blues, but God damn, man, just keep a little bit more of that energy and just fucking push that net. And you were so close to breaking him again. You were in his head. He was going to have to go back home and study some more. But yeah, I'm looking forward to these first two games. We were at Winnipeg with Dallas. Now, I haven't watched the games, but, I am looking forward to them going back to Dallas and just seeing if they continue to lose it away. Because I feel like on the road, and if Dallas just starts fucking really fucking with Hellebuyck, like calling him out, calling Connor, if I feel like some Blues fans need to show up in Dallas and crank it up like they did at Enterprise and get that fucker to pull out. Out of the goal. It's not even so much Winnipeg as a team. It is just Connor Hellebuyck. There's something about that guy I just fucking can't stand. He just seems so douchey. I guess there's a few things I've already addressed as Agent Fox Mulder's trying to call the shit out of me. Are you a Hellebuyck fan? Don't tell me that. We are a Blues family in this household. You better just chill out. It's Blues all the way, buddy. You just better respect. Respect my authority. I know, I can't change what's in your heart, man. You are mainly white all over, so it's like a whiteout going on your fur there. I gotta believe, though, you're not a Winnipeg fan. You better not be. Definitely not a Connor Hellebuyck fan. You should have been like asking for him to get pulled. Tomorrow is Mother's Day, though. I'm actually trying to record this one as quick as possible and get it thrown out on the internet so I can get up early for Mother's Day and meet up with Shelly and Nabina there with while taking my mother, or our mother rather, to the zoo. Possibly hit up, depending on what time we leave and stuff, might try to hit up U City and go to like the Loop there. And I believe I mentioned this before, maybe hit up Vintage Vinyl and maybe pick up a movie or two. Or a vinyl. I think they have some records there. Which I love that the Blues have so many commercials of Vintage Vinyl. It's two things that I love. The Blues and the Vintage Vinyl. Good shit. I don't know that we're going to hit Jilly's or not tomorrow. The Cupcake Bar and Cafe. Which we usually do. But we're going to the zoo like when they open. Which is going to make it very difficult to hit Jilly's first. So... you know, I don't, they may not be open by the time we get out of the zoo. So we'll see what happens. See, right, right, Mr. Fox? Meow. Anyway, I'm a little nervous as he is on the desk, like aimed right at me. His head's like looking right at my crotch and his one front paw that is still there. It's dangling off the desk, ready to strike at any moment, and he's like wagging his tail as he just looks like he wants to fuck me up. What gives, man? What gives? Why are you being like this, homie? Oh, there he goes. He jumped off the desk. There we go. I'm safe now. Now he's just gonna bite my legs. I think he's about to lay down. I think he's uninterested at the moment with whatever the fuck it is I'm doing over here. But yeah, we'll definitely hit the old zoo tomorrow for the Mother's Day. And happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. Especially and though she's passed on, got to give it to the mother from Psycho, you know? Vera Farmiga's character in the Bates Motel, you know, Norman Bates' mom. I forgot what her fucking name was. Norman's mom. Which, never would have thought they would have had, like, Vera Farmiga play her. It was the younger her. But, you know, attractive, very attractive Vera Farmiga, which I feel like Norman Bates' mother should have been not attractive. Which the Bates Motel was an entertaining show. But there is just that, it's Psycho. Anthony Perkins was such a good Psycho. The Vince Vaughn version was just a little weird. I don't know, the way he played him stuff was a little bit, I don't know. As I enjoy the Anthony Perkins one where he's just completely batshit crazy. I feel like he is kind of maybe how Ed Gein was. I like the original? I believe it was the original Psycho. Although maybe it was like the second. I want to say it was the original where Anthony Perkins is sitting there in the jail cell and the fly just keeps flying over his head and he's not moving an inch, not blinking an eye, and just the fly all over his head. I gotta look that up. That scene is so good. And he's not trying to... I think there's some... It's been forever since I've seen it. Fly scene. Here we go. Let's watch a little bit of that. I don't think the audio of that commercial came through, but I could hear it in my heads. In my cans. I gotta pull up the scene because... There is the he's talking about he wouldn't hurt a fly and whatnot. As this is the original Psycho. It's just a classic scene. I remembered the scene being in black and white, so I was like, I'm pretty sure that's the original. Oh, yeah, it's the mom talking. As Anthony Perkins was so young then. Oh, he's dead now, but it's weird that I can hear this. It's not recording the sound. He's quite the stare on him. But yeah, it's his mother talking about he wouldn't harm a fly. Like, here we go. Where's the fly? Where's the fly? Much better fly scene than the fly episode of Breaking Bad. One of the few episodes where I was not crazy about, which that's one of those divisive ones. People either love it or hate it. I used to really hate it. I'm kind of indifferent to it now, but the Breaking Bad one. Oh, I forgot about the smirk on his hand, on his face when the fly lands on him. It's this big old smirk. I was thinking it was more to that scene because the fly just lands on his hand. I was thinking it like flew around his face, but I guess not. I was wrong. My memory fucks with me yet again. But I hadn't seen that movie in, fuck, I don't know how long. It's been several years. I shouldn't feel too bad about forgetting. Scene that has been many, many, many years since I had seen. Anyway. Yeah. Psycho. I don't even remember why. Oh, Mother's Day. Yeah. Mother's Day. That's the mother I think of is. I just think Anthony Perkins in drag, pretending to be his mother, which was, you know, based on serial killer Ed Gein. As he liked to dress as a woman and pretend to be his mother as a. He was a fucked up individual, shall we say. And I was trying to think of like another crazy mother. But, oh, the mother from Sopranos. That was a good one. that was classic. definitely going to have to do the classic Mother's Day song, Mother Lover from Lonely Island, with the one Justin Timberlake in the mix there has been a Mother's Day tradition for traveling to the zoo is to play some Mother Lover. And fighting the on. Son of a bitch. Yeah, anyway. I don't know that we have a plan where we're going to eat to yet. I imagine we'll hit. Often at times we end up going to Blueberry Hill, but maybe we'll go to Fitz's or something. Go somewhere. We've been to Fitz's in the past, but we shall see. I mean, Fitz's has some pretty great food. And you get to watch them bottle the soda. Although, if Fitz's is like one of those dangerous places for me to go, whatever I eat there, it's going to be rough. I'm going to overeat. Pretty much guarantee all their servings are really big. They got the floats that are just like a full, it's like what you would imagine a float would be if you went to Munich. It is a full liter of root beer or whatever soda they're using, because you can get it with like grape soda, which I usually go like a grape or something to that effect. But they got grape soda, and like they have the Purple Haze is one of them that I remember. They have the grape soda with the, I guess it's just vanilla ice cream. I'm not sure what ice cream was in there. But I mean, you're talking like a full liter Stein and then full of soda, and then it's like three or four big, large, very large scoops of ice cream. And it is a lot to just take that. And then their food portions of their normal food, if I recall, it's been several years since I've been to Fitz's up on Del Mar. But they got some large amounts of food. And if I overeat these days, I feel like I'm going to die. So I'm getting you know, having issues as it is these days, I don't need to fucking make it even worse by downing way too much food. I plan on trying to survive tomorrow. I feel like I will survive at least another day. And that's, well, I was thinking there was more I had to talk about, but nothing's coming to mind. I know that I'm not done with painting, unfortunately. I've definitely slowed down as it's been more difficult to get shit done. I've also been obscenely tired. But I did get the primer done in the dining room. I primed all the walls, and I finally got like one full coat on all the walls last night. I don't know that I'm going to paint it all anymore today. We'll see what happens. Again, I got to get up pretty fucking early tomorrow. But, man, it just seems like such slow going right now. And waiting, just hoping that I finish it at some point. It's starting to feel like I don't know that I'm ever going to finish it. But I really want that the downstairs to be done. I mean, I had such a clear... I mean, look great in my brain. And it's a bit stressful not having it done. And wanting it done is just like, oh, fuck. You know, I got my whole kitchen and dining room unusable right now. I've still managed to clear enough space to, like, cook some food and stuff. But, I mean, it is... I'm not using my table other than to keep painting shit on it. And hopefully, I've got it covered in cardboard and shit. I'm hoping I didn't get any paint. I don't think I got any paint on her. Hopefully, I didn't miss a spot or something. Or I know that I took a couple of nicks out of my flooring downstairs because I had screwdrivers and shit on my ladder. And a hammer at one point fell off the ladder. And took a little chunk. There was like at least 2 to 3 spots where I took a little chunk out of the flooring. As it's just unfortunate. It always happens near the end of the night too, when I'm just fucking tired as shit, and just want to get it all done. And then next thing you know, it's like, son of a bitch. Like, my shit's all fucked up. I should have stopped like 15 minutes ago, but I didn't. And this is the kind of shit that happens. Is that ice cream truck out there? Sounds like an ice cream truck. Not that I want ice cream, it was just not used to hearing that. Anywho, that's really all I've got for this one. So I guess, as always, that is a kid in a wheelchair, not a trash can.